Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello, and welcome to An Hour of Mind Power. This is Donna Sebo. We've got a wonderful interview coming up on the program. However, my guest has been stuck in traffic and is just very close to his office, so he'll be coming on with us in a few minutes. In the meanwhile, I wanted to share some information with you, and I think sometimes we have choices that we want to make. Sometimes there are choices we feel like we have to make. But I wanted to start off with a quote by Pat Mitchell, who's the CEO of the Museum of Television and Radio in New York City. He says, "You're going to be challenged constantly by those who are not sure, so you have to believe you're doing the right thing." Challenged constantly. My goodness, that's what we always go through. How many times have we wondered how we were going to balance our jobs and our lives? I was talking with a young woman this morning. She said, "Gee, my husband's lucky if he gets a packaged pasta dinner, because I'm working, I've got a baby, I'm having to do all kinds of special interviews and processing of documents." She said, "This is part of my job, plus taking care of an elderly father," and she's going through all of these various things that she has to do, constant balancing act. And she said at one point she finally burned out. So there are things we have to consider. And there's a gentleman by the name of John Donahoe. He was the president of the eBay Marketplaces, and he felt like he had some insights that he could offer. When he was 23 years old and he started his career with a management consulting firm, Bain & Company, he was just really excited because what he could just see was this golden role of opportunity for advancement and rewards. And his wife reminded him that with what he was getting into, he was going to have to also put in a lot of long hours, a lot of travel, high stress. And she asked him, "Do you really want that? Is that really where you want to be?" Well, he thought about it, and there was a moment of insight where he said, "Nope, that's really not what he wanted." He said, "I do not choose to live the life of a management consultant," meaning not that he wouldn't work for the company, but that he wouldn't let his job narrow his personal life. Well, he went to business school, and in the very first year of business school, he was tested. His wife was expecting, and she went into labor during the time he was doing his final exams, and he had to decide whether he was going to stay with her or concentrate wholly on the test. Well, what he did is he reduced his study sessions, and he spent a lot of time with her. And he was surprised at how well he actually did on his tests when he made that choice. Actually, he did better than most of the students who had studied obsessively. So he learned a lesson. Focusing your efforts while remaining relaxed and confident about your priorities can pay off. And then he said another test came when his wife finished law school and wanted to accept a clerkship with a federal judge. Now, to make this work, Donahoe would have to reduce his travel and hours, and he was quite willing to do so, but he thought he was going to have to quit his job to be able to make this adjustment. However, he did something. He went and he talked to his manager. Now, his manager didn't want to lose him as an employee because he had just accomplished so much. His potential was so great. So what he did is he reduced Donahoe's assignment to limited hours for a single local client. So what Donahoe learned there is don't throw up your hands in despair. Leverage your achievements to get what you need. All of these things are so important in life. They are extremely important in life. Why? Because it is something that we need to keep in mind. We need to remember. We need to realize that there are options perhaps we wouldn't have even thought were available. There are options out there for us. So sometimes we need to make it okay to ask about what options might be available. and also to make some adjustments on our own, realizing that those adjustments can work out just beautifully. You know, all of our choices for each one of us are going to be different. And if we sort out our priorities, we might be amazed at the resources we can use to achieve exactly what we're aiming for. We can balance our life and we can still keep moving forward. I like what he said, and I thought I would share that with you today. Our guest this afternoon is Rich Dolan, and I know that my engineer is calling his office right now because Mr. Dolan was in traffic on the way to his office, and we are going to be talking today about UFOs and the national security state. I have to tell you that his book really intrigued me. It intrigued me a great deal because of all of the facts and information that he had in it. So as soon as my engineer is able to make the contact at his office, we'll be bringing him on air, and you will be able to hear some of the phenomenal facts and information that he has to share. So as soon as we have him on the line, we will be bringing him on to the show with you. Now, I did want to let you know that we will be opening the phone lines later on in the show, but I don't know exactly what time that will be. So we will announce that to you also as we get close to it. Let's just digress for a little bit. You know, sometimes we get very concerned about putting on the pounds. Well, if you really want to be able to get some pounds off faster, walking is one activity that is a very good one for you to be able to utilize. Why? Because just about anybody and everybody can do it. And they have found in experiments with women, we gals are always complaining about how the guys seem to be able to drop the pounds so much more readily than we can. Well, they say women who alternate between a fast pace that leaves them breathless and an easy does it slower pace while walking or working out seem to burn 36% more fat. Now, this is from Canadian research. Also, there is a great deal of information that is about children and their sleeping habits. You know, children that are under the age of 2 who sleep with a light on are 5 times more likely to develop nearsightedness, myopia, by the time they're 16 than children who sleep in the total dark. Now, who would have thought that? You wouldn't think that that would make any difference. Well, the researchers at the University of Pennsylvania said even a nightlight makes them 3 times more prone to myopia. So it's something that does make a difference. These are little things. We don't think about them. We don't think it's a big deal. But apparently, for children under the age of 2 specifically, apparently after that it doesn't make any difference. But under the age of 2, remember, they're growing, they're developing, and it's a good thing to be aware of. And, hey, they sleep so soundly. By golly, if you observe babies, you're always, always amazed at how well they do, how well they can go to sleep in any situation, any condition. And they don't seem to care about lights very much. We do more than they do when we're the adults. Donna Sebo here, and we are waiting to hear about our guest coming on, and my engineer is calling him, and as soon as we are able to make contact, then we will be doing that, and they will be letting me know, and Rich Dolan will be on the air. What about a lot of stress? You know, I was talking about the one gentleman just a moment ago, and how he dealt with certain decisions in his life. And stress is something that we frequently find ourselves experiencing. Sometimes, because of stress, we may end up with a physical condition that we just don't know how we're going to handle. And that makes us even more stressed. And we just find ourselves going in circles. Well, Elizabeth Anna is a woman that found a way to actually deal with an extremely high level of stress, as well as helping her to beat a disease. Now, this is her story. Elizabeth started having problems with bleeding. And she said female problems ran in her family, especially her mother's side. And heck, she was 42 years of age. It could be premenopause. So she wasn't too concerned. However, it didn't stop. It didn't go away. And Elizabeth Anna, well, she hadn't had a pap smear in years. And first story. You're going to want to hear the rest of it, and we're going to continue it. But right now, we're going to be going to our guest, Rich Dolan. Rich, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you for having me on. I'm glad to be here.
Well, it's a delight having you, and for the fact that we have been able to make the connection, it's absolutely wonderful.
People have no idea.
Well, I know traffic jams get to be a bear, and we all experience them at one time or another.
I rushed just this moment to my house. My wife had the telephone in her hand saying, "Here you go."
She said, "Donna called. You're on air."
I'm very glad that worked out. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Rich.
Great.
Your book, to me, is absolutely amazing, and I would say incredible
at the
same time. Now, the title of Richard Dolan's book is UFOs and the National Security State. It's a chronology of a cover-up from 1941 to 1973.
Right.
Dr. Edgar Mitchell, Apollo 14 astronaut, read it and said it's a thorough and monumental undertaking, and I would put about 50 exclamation points behind that statement.
It was a crazy-making undertaking.
Absolutely. I don't know how you kept all this stuff straight. I really don't.
Well, I want my audience
to know a little bit about you. You studied at Alfred University and Oxford University before you did your graduate work in history at the University of Rochester, where you were a finalist for a Rhodes Scholarship. Now, UFOs were not always your interest. You were also involved in studying the U.S. Cold War strategy, Soviet history and culture, and international diplomacy.
Right.
And you live in Rochester, New York.
Yes.
Richard, one, how in the world did you ever get involved with UFOs?
People are naturally interested in this because I come from such a standard kind of academic background. I really had no overwhelming interest in this topic. What I had in the early years was what I would call an average level of interest. In other words, I mean, most people, if they're watching a television documentary on UFOs or some kind of neat thing, they'll sit and they'll watch it and maybe even be intrigued, and then at the end of it, scratch their head, and then typically turn the channel and you move on to other things. And that was basically my situation for many years. So it wasn't as if I was a hardcore skeptic, but I wasn't a believer or a skeptic. I was really just a nothing. I was an agnostic, essentially. But what happened was that in the early 1990s, I did become interested in the UFO topic. Now, prior to that, my interest, I did a lot of, I guess you might call cloak and dagger type studies. Back when I was doing, I did a lot of German history, for example, and I studied the origins of Germany's political policing system in the 1870s, 1880s. I mean, completely forgotten stuff today, but it was something that I was really digging into, sort of like Germany's version of the FBI back then.
Yes.
And I did a lot of study of other European secret agencies, Russia's Okhrana under the Tsar, Austrian secret police under the age of Metternich back in the 19th century. So it was kind of things that I was interested in, all this spying on the public, keeping things hidden, and so on. And then I moved on into U.S. diplomatic studies, Cold War history primarily, dealing with things like the birth of the CIA and the birth of the Defense Department and so on. So, again, continuing that same theme of looking at spy stuff in a way.
Mm-hmm.
So it really wasn't that big a leap going from that mindset or that type of study into the UFO field, which really, as I've come to see and as many people see, is one aspect, really, of the cloak and dagger world. The UFO topic is of interest to a certain portion of the intelligence community. Now, what happened was that in the early 90s, I had two specific things that kind of really triggered my interest. One was walking through a bookstore and seeing a copy of Timothy Good's classic work, Above Top Secret. And this was in 1994. I had no idea who Timothy Good was, anything about this book, but I remember walking into a store, and the book was on a display standing right in front of me, Above Top Secret, the Worldwide UFO Cover-Up. And it's a big, fat book, and I thought, wow, that's interesting, and I remember flipping through it. thinking, I recognize that name, I recognize that department, and these documents here, they seem to be valid. Are they valid? And so on. I bought the book and really dived into it. The other thing that, at the same time, I remember trolling through what was then the internet. It was basically Usenet bulletin board groups. One was Alt Paranet UFO, and I remember reading a lot of articles by a few people who I thought were very intelligent. One in particular, a man who's become a friend of mine, who wrote a lot of politically oriented UFO types of pieces. And I thought, I like this guy's approach. And it occurred to me that I was living in what I consider to be a culturally schizophrenic society, in a sense of...
you know, I love that description.
Right. It's my own little coined phrase, I'm happy to say, where you have official truth, on the one hand, things that we're supposed to believe, and then you have, let's call it unofficial truth, that is, mm-hmm. things that people actually do believe and that are actually real.
Right.
I'd spent the summer, some years before, in East Germany, when it was still behind the Iron Curtain and so forth, and had a direct experience. I had very many good East German dissident friends. And I experienced this cultural schizophrenia where you'd have to read the official newspaper, and then you go into somebody's house and hear them literally whispering about the actual news. And I thought, wow. But this is, you get this everywhere. And you get it here in America regarding the UFO topic.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, well, here's the question. My question was not, are UFOs real, at least not initially. My question was very basic, which is, was this actually a topic ever that was as seriously taken as it appears when you read a book like Timothy Good's about
mm-hmm.
Top Secret?
Mm-hmm.
And if it was taken seriously, even as a mistake, let's say that they mistakenly thought UFOs were something important, why would that not have been in any academic history book that I had ever read? Would it not be interesting to go back to 1950 and to be a fly on the wall of some important general and have this person truly wondering about the seriousness of the flying saucer problem? Well, I think it's very interesting. And so for that reason, as a purely historical phenomenon, I began my formal study of the UFO phenomenon from a military intelligence community angle primarily, trying to find out if this was something that was a big deal to them. And as you know, having read the book, the answer is absolutely positively, it's a very big deal to them. It was in the 1940s, it was in the 50s, it was in the 60s, and it's never stopped. It's been a big deal to this very day.
Without question. I want to refer to a quote that you have in the book by Michelle de Montaigne, and correct me if I'm mispronouncing the person.
Montaigne, yes, indeed.
Yes,
Michelle de Montaigne.
Montaigne. To condemn a thing thus, dogmatically, as false and impossible, is to assume the distinction of knowing the bounds and limits of God's will and of the power of our Mother Nature. It is dangerous and presumptuous. Besides, the absurd temerity that it implies to disdain what we do not comprehend. That, to me, is such a powerful quote.
Thank you for reminding me that I included it.
Yes.
I had forgotten. I'm a very big fan of Montaigne.
It is such a powerful, powerful quote. Because too easy to say, it's not possible. Look at how science throughout the centuries.
Absolutely.
Different organizations said that is not possible. The world is flat. I mean, that's a ridiculous one to bring up, but it's that simplistic sometimes.
50 years ago, in the year, I think it was 1957, the head of the Royal Astronomical Society, in the year 1957, three, 4 years before the first manned, first person went into space, said, space travel is bunk.
Right.
Oh, no, bilge. Utter bilge.
Mm-hmm.
You know, garbage.
That is what I feel your book, if someone is willing to read it, I mean, really read it. I've got so many pages dog-eared and highlighted.
I'm glad to hear that.
All kinds of stuff. That's just the way I go through books when I'm reviewing them. This is the first comprehensive study of the U.S. government's response to the intrusion of UFO phenomena in the American skies over the last 50 years. And this is stated by Jacques Vallée, and it's the first sentence in the foreword in your book, and the statement, the citizenry has been left not just uninformed, but indeed misinformed. Today's world is a world of tremendous change. With that change, there's fear for those that don't want the change, and then those that are willing to embrace the change are demanding more and more truth. A lot of old establishments are crumbling. A lot of structures, politically, socially, environmentally, so many things are decomposing, I would say.
I agree with you.
And consequently, just as in the natural form of life, if you're out in the forest, you see it happen, certain things will decompose so that new life can come out from it. And I think your book is a phenomenal expose. I mean, parts of it read like a James Bond movie, and it's terrifyingly real. This is not made up, and I know it's not made up because of some of the experiences I've had and people that I've known through the years.
Indeed.
And when you read this, it reminds the individual of how important it is to stay prudent and to demand, to ask for the truth, not the fluff.
That is so well put. And one thing that I would really want to emphasize about the manner of how I went through putting this book together, it is a very radical book. It's not just a UFO history. It's really my attempt to reinterpret American history and to an extent world history with the UFO problem inserted into it. So it, in a sense, it's a reevaluation of the big picture. And it's radical on that basis. But the other thing about it is that there are UFO studies and books that deal with even more far-out stories than I elected to include.
Mm-hmm.
I only included accounts that I felt were really rock-solid, reliable, in particular accounts that focused on military documents, that, you know, whenever possible.
Mm-hmm.
And so the foundation of it's very strong, and I think for that reason, in a sense, I almost understated some of the things happening, and yet because I really tried to document and just thoroughly back up everything to the maximum extent possible, I think that a number of readers have said that had its own very powerful effect. I tried to create a very solid foundation for further debate and argument.
And I think that anyone that would read your material would, if they were inclined to become more involved in research, would be actually empowered with more resources for knowing the right kinds of questions to ask. Because it's only going from 41 to 73.
Right.
I mean, 73 to 2007, we have had a heck of a lot going on. But
this is what I'm now working on.
Good, you'll have to send me that book.
The second book, the follow-up, is something that I have been working on since I really finished the first. And it's been a long, long haul, but I'm happy to say the research for this second book has been done actually for about a year now, and it's going up to the present day. It will be not less than 700 pages, whereas the first book is about 500 pages, roughly. This one will be more than 700.
Mm-hmm.
The amount of work going into this follow-up volume is multiple times more than went into this first book. And to be perfectly honest with you, I will never, ever undertake the kind of project that I'm now trying to finish, because it's almost more work than I'm physically able to do.
Mm-hmm.
The good news is I have several hundred nicely polished pages that are already done. In fact, earlier today I was working on the book some more, and I'm happy, very happy with what I've written. It's just a matter of getting this whole thing done in a satisfactory way so I can get it out to the world and then really let the chips fall where they may. But in fact, the story for the last 30, 35 years is that this phenomenon, of course, as we all know, has not gone away. It has continued to engage militaries of all nations, really all major nations from around the world, not simply the United States military, but China, Britain, Russia, France. Pilots are up, and not always military, but sometimes commercial airliners.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that's really become very clear is that there are an alarming number of instances where commercial airliner pilots are reporting sometimes very large objects alarmingly close to their aircraft. In some cases, these objects come right at the airplane and then veer off at the last moment. And these pilots, at times, are feeling a moment of mortal terror, wondering, am I going to die? And then this thing zips away. And a lot of times, they have a hard time deciding how to report such a thing. Because there's such a stigma within the airline industry against talking about this kind of thing. I've spoken to many, many pilots personally about this. And there are a number of them who have encountered very bizarre phenomena that they cannot explain. And they don't always know how to bring this up, because there have been cases where pilots have brought this up and they've been reassigned to desk jobs and things like this. I mean, they've actually been punished, in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
Well, but on the other hand, you've got a safety issue.
Well, it's something else, too. And I don't know why there is such an elitist attitude on the part of quote-unquote political officials. But I think they seem to have an attitude that the public in general is really stupid, and that we don't have the capability of even understanding 50 cents worth of the information that's there. And it just really, I listen to some of the attitudes of these people that have these dispositions, and I go, where are your brains, for heaven's sakes? Most of you in these positions don't even have IQs past 130, so why are you judging the rest of the population? I guess they're judging them according to themselves, and I'm being a little sarcastic here. But I think there is this idea, number one, we want to make sure that we know more than the average person does. We don't want the average person to know more than we do, because they may get out of control, or they may ask us questions we are not prepared for, and consequently we'll lose our positioning of authority and power and respect, or whatever it is. And to me, it's like, let's be open about this, let's talk about this, so we get past the ignorance, the superstition, and the fear.
Right.
And it's something.
Yeah, I think you're really onto something. There's a widespread, very deep and broad acceptance by a lot of people about the reality of this phenomenon.
Absolutely.
But people are typically not shouting up from the rooftops, because they think that everybody else, you know, thinks they would be crazy, when in fact it's the majority of people who actually believe in this. And so it's a strange thing. You think, what does it mean culturally and politically and socially when a large number of people feel incapable socially of talking about a certain topic, even though they're interested? Is that a sign of repression? And I would say the answer is yes. And when you start analyzing the structures of power within our corporate society here that we have, I mean, what we see is that power is a top-down phenomenon, and our political institutions are deeply connected with the corporate media, for example. They all kind of own each other, really, when you start studying the relationships. So what I've come to see is that there are those people at the top of our little food chain who are well-positioned to understand what is going on. And it is not in their interest to have the rest of us poor slobs discuss this matter. So what do? It's not like there's this massive conspiracy at the major media, like at NBC or ABC, among the executive producers. They're not in on this stuff. The way it works is very simple. It's not so crass as, you know, a cigarette-smoking man sitting behind Tom Brokaw telling him what he can't say. It doesn't work like that. I think the way it works is, when you get into a corporation, there's a corporate culture that is in place. And if you want to get promoted, instinctively, you will look at your superior, your supervisor, he or her, however that person talks or dresses or the kinds of jokes they like. People tend to mimic what goes on at the level above, and that's how you get promoted.
Mm-hmm.
You learn to think like your boss, who in turn learns to think like his or her boss, and it starts at the top. And let's look at the top. More than 50% of anything that any person is likely to see, hear, or read in the course of their daily life is owned by one of five corporations in the world right now. They own a majority of media, whether that's books, magazines, TV shows, movies, whatever. And then when you add the next five after that, the top 10, it's a virtual stranglehold of information. So what does that mean? Well, it means is that, especially when you study the relationship of those corporations to the global intelligence community, and there's a real relationship there. We know for sure that the CIA has had very intimate relations with mainstream American media and global media since its inception. Now, we don't know all the details. They're not just, you know, letting that out. But we do know that there's been paid relationships, covertly.
All right. Rick, I want to take a break here. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to continue this. Because, again, your book, UFOs and the National Security State, A Chronology of a Cover-Up, 1941 to 1973, is one of the most impressive books I have ever read regarding historical data relative to UFOs, but also to so many other aspects of events and activities going on in that period, secrecy, etc. So we're taking a break for just a moment. Don't go away. Richard M. Dolan, the author, is going to be with us, and we're going to continue. So don't go away. We'll be right back.
If you're searching for the perfect gift for a child, consider God's Kiss by Donna Sebo. That's right. Donna is not only a mental practitioner and psychic, she's an author as well. God's Kiss beckons all children and the young at heart to enter the dream world of a little traveler named Johnny. You can order your book today by sending a check or money order to Mrs. Sebo's Classics, Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. That's Post Office Box 97272. Tacoma, Washington, 98497. If you'd like both the book and cassette, you pay $19.95 plus applicable tax and shipping charges. This is the book for your favorite child of any age. Donna Sebo's God's Kiss is about a child's sense of place in the world, and it's destined to be a children's classic. Order now. Call 800-872-8852. God's Kiss is written by Donna Sebo and illustrated by Ed Ged Rose. Buy it today. 800-872-8852.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature, however, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Hello, this is Donna Sebo, and we're continuing our conversation with Richard M. Dolan, his fabulous book, UFOs and the National Security State. This is a chronology of a cover-up, 1941 to 1973. This book is so well done, and there is so much good information in it that you will literally be captivated from the very first page as you go through it. Sometimes you get so much information you have to put the book down, go get yourself a cup of coffee or a glass of pop or water or something, take a break to be able to digest a lot of the information. Richard, you have a quote in here by CIA Director Richard Helms. The first rule in keeping secrets is, quote, nothing on paper, unquote.
Exactly.
And of course, we had Theodore Roosevelt was not, you know, that just was very much a part of him in his
right.
thinking. and as it has been for many individuals in positions of power. What I wanted to do was go back to 1947.
Okay.
Go back a little bit early in history, because your chronology of things as they evolved, and so much of this was publicly recorded, and a lot of it was just totally evaporated out and away from the public view.
Right.
But I had a particular empathy, because I'm in the Pacific Northwest, with the story about June 24th, 1927,
right,
where the pilot and businessman Kenneth Arnold from Boise, Idaho, was flying near Mount Rainier. And there is a lot of activity out at Mount Rainier. More than one person over the years, and I've been in this area for 26 years, more than one person has said that they see activity out there, strange lights that go on where there should be no lights. And they know it's not military aircraft, and there's different things. So there's a lot of legend, if you will, about Mount Rainier. Tell us about this particular event, because this guy was searching for a downed C-46 Marine transport.
That's right. Yeah, Kenneth Arnold, this is the sighting that really kicked off the flying saucer mania, you might say, in the United States back in 1947. He was a 32-year-old private pilot who he was a pretty active flyer at that time. And in fact, this the transport plane, as you mentioned, had gone down, crashed, and there was an active search going on for it, and a reward for finding out, for anyone who located where it crashed. And in fact, a few days after Arnold flew, the crash was located. But Kenneth Arnold was out that way, passing by Mount Rainier. He knew that area very well. He had flown by it many, many times before. And something caught his attention, the glint of something, and what he ended up seeing, going left to right across his field of vision, between two peaks, Mount Rainier and another peak, were these approximately nine, I believe, objects moving at a very high rate. He got a pretty good look at them, he said. In fact, he was looking for wings, couldn't really see that. It looked like they had a very, very severe swept back kind of look, as he later said. But these objects were moving along, almost hopping, he said, as if a saucer would if you were to skim it along the water.
Mm-hmm.
Hence the phrase flying saucer when he mentioned this to the press. The thing about the sighting, though, that really got everyone in a puzzle was over how Arnold calculated the speed of these objects. He could see visually that they were moving really fast. I mean, back in 1947, like a typical fighter aircraft was hitting speeds of like 400 miles per hour, maybe a little bit more. Arnold's watching objects that he calculated, I mean, because he knew the distance between the two peaks. And so he calculated the distance, actually at about 1,700 miles per hour, but he thought that's way too high, and so he tried to find a reason to round it down, and he got it down to 1,200 miles per hour, which is still absolutely way beyond any kind of speed that was then attainable by any aircraft that we were flying. The sighting made a very big impression on Arnold. He came down, landed, told the press, and, you know, it just swept the country,
mm-hmm.
the so-called flying saucer. And the reason that it had the resonance, I think it did, was in large part because of Arnold himself, who is a very responsible, very professional man. In fact, he later ran for lieutenant governor of the state of Idaho. So he was a very well-known and well-respected individual. And then, of course, we learned, people learned shortly thereafter, there were other sightings even that day in that area, probably of the same objects. There was a prospector out that way, a fellow named Fred Johansson, I believe, who also saw this object. He was interviewed by the FBI, these objects, I should say. And so there was a very big flurry of sightings in the Pacific Northwest in June going into July of 1947. At the same time, of course, there was that wave of sightings was going on in the southwestern U.S., most notably, everyone knows about the Roswell case. But there were other cases that were actually very well documented. There was one on July 8, 1947, over what later became known as Edwards Air Force Base. At the time was called Muroc Airfield. And I've got all the documents on this. This is very clear-cut. A number of Air Force personnel very clearly saw in four separate occasions over Muroc that day objects that were moving in highly unconventional ways at high speeds that didn't look like any kind of aircraft and were going against the wind. These were not balloons. They were just, these were objects that were moving. And this, in fact, was a particular sighting that really got the attention of the Air Force, we now know in retrospect. There were many such. And in fact, what happened was that while the Army and the Army Air Force is telling the public that there's nothing to all this, these are hallucinations, there is a very high-level memo that went out from Air Materiel Command at Wright-Patterson Wright Airfield back in 1947, known to most people as the Twining Memo. But General Nathan Twining, he was a three-star general at the time, later became four-star, wrote a memo in which he's writing about these objects very clearly based on all the military reports that he was seeing. And the quotes that he has out of this memo are, for example, objects real, not visionary or fictitious. He describes extreme rates of climb, maneuverability, and action which must be considered evasive when sighted in his document. My favorite statement in that memo describes the objects as circular or elliptical in shape, flat on bottom and domed on top. That's a direct quote. Now, you go back to 1947 and you're reading a memo by a three-star general that's describing these objects in that way, and you have to ask, stop the bus here, who's flying objects in 1947 that are elliptical in shape, flat on bottom and domed on top? That's a flying saucer. Who's flying such objects in 1947? That's the question. And guess what? This was a question that was being asked very actively within intelligence circles in the United States. Question number one is, was this a Soviet development? We're in the early stages of the Cold War. It's a reasonable question to ask. But the answer appeared then and now to be no. There's no evidence. There wasn't any then, and there is no evidence now that the Soviets invented flying saucers at that time. Next question, well, is it some secret thing that we're working on, some deep black U.S. research and development program? Another fair question to ask. And there are people who even today speculate or even believe that these are secret, purely terrestrial projects. But frankly, when you start looking for evidence, the evidence is, it's not that strong. It's possible. One thing that I wish that I had done a little differently, if I had one regret over that book, it's that I feel that I would like to have taken more an in-depth look at German technological development during World War II, because it turns out that the Germans were, in fact, a little more advanced in developing disc-shaped airframes than I had considered. And it was really only after I read Nick Cook's very excellent book, The Hunt for Zero Point, which really describes that whole thing very well. But, you know, better late better late than never. You can't get everything at first.
Absolutely.
So there's a possible argument, in other words, you can make for us having invented flying saucers. But here's the problem, okay? A, there are many, many eyewitness accounts of people who say they saw aliens. That's a problem. B, when you go through the history of these objects, this is a more serious problem. They are of such a nature that the confrontations with the U.S. military, they're very provocative. These objects are coming into sensitive airspace time and again. My book lists about 300 military encounters with UFOs, and most of these, they're, you know, where jets are being scrambled, an object seen over a sensitive, restricted area. They're seen visually. Sometimes they're tracked on radar simultaneously, and pilots are scrambled to go intercept. And there have been cases where the pilot goes out there and gets a visual and sees it as an unconventional disc-framed, disc-shaped object, and it zips off. We have a handful of good military documents that lay this out. So now the question is, if this is secret technology, technology, if the U.S. is developing this, the behavior of many of these objects doesn't make any sense as a kind of secret or black project. And it's one thing to say, well, maybe they're testing your defenses, but is this something that you would do for 50 or 60 years?
Or even longer than that.
Well, right, I'm just thinking from the 1940s, mm-hmm. really, till today.
Right.
Is this, I mean, it doesn't make sense to me. So for anyone who's going to argue that all of these UFOs, the real ones, are terrestrial technology, I think that they're really not looking at the detailed history of these events. It's easy to say on the surface, oh, yeah, we've invented our own. But in fact, the devil is in the details. And when you start looking at the individual cases, that explanation becomes very weak. Now, I do believe that we have, I say we loosely, that U.S. secret, deep within the bowels of the National Security community, that someone has invented or developed very exotic technology based on acquired alien technology. I personally believe that that has happened, and I believe that some of the results have been fairly successful.
Richard, I'm going to have to interrupt you. My guest is Richard Dolan. We're just about out of time here with Richard. Richard, you have so much wonderful information in your book, UFOs and the National Security State, The Chronology of a Cover-Up, 1941 to 1973. You give excellent information about historical facts. You have an awesome bibliography in the back of your book. You have things itemized out where people can check things. Say, just don't take what I'm saying to be gospel. Look it up. Find out what needs to know. You give information about documents, Richard. Do you have a website that people can go to?
I do indeed. And it's keyholepublishing.com. Just like looking through a keyhole, keyholepublishing.com. If that's too much work, you can just Google my name, Richard Dolan, any search engine, and usually at the top, you'll get my webpage there.
Richard Dolan has been my guest today. His fabulous book, and in my view, a book that you should have in your library. It's a book you curl up with. It'll make you think. It'll make you analyze. It will make you question. And if you question enough, you might even want to do more research on your own. It really is an eye-opener on so many levels. Richard, I want to thank you for being my guest today.
Donna, it was a pleasure, and I'd be happy to chat with you any other time.
Well, it will be something I look forward to.
Great.
Richard Dolan is my guest. His website is keyholepublishing.com. That's K-E-Y-H-O-L-E, publishing.com. Or just go and Google Richard Dolan, D-O-L-A-N. And you'll find out about his site. Again, his material is outstanding. It's one of the best written pieces I've ever come across. No woo-woo stuff here, folks. This is the real thing. This is documented information. Richard, thank you again for being my guest. This is Donna Siebel. We're going to be taking a break. We'll be back in just a moment.
As a counselor, Donna Siebel is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800-872-8852. That's 253-582-5604 or outside of Pierce County, 800-872-8852. Enter the magical world of God's Kiss.
Johnny finds himself at the entrance to a large open valley, framed by high mountains rich in the brown red colors of the earth. He stands in awe, even a little fearful of the mountain's great size. After all, he's just a little boy and not very tall.
God's Kiss is a beautifully illustrated children's book about a young boy's journey into a valley with children and animals from all over the world. They are gathering together to experience the wonder of love and beauty that will affect their lives forever. A talking book audio narrated by the author Donna Siebel accompanies this wonderful storybook, creating a special magic all of its own. This book package makes a wonderful gift for those special children in your life ages 3 to 10. God's Kiss book and talking book audio are only $19.95 plus shipping and handling, and the author
author Donna Sebo will autograph and personalize your book if you request it. Call 800-872-8852. You can also order through Donna Sebo's website, www.delphiinternational.com. That 800 number again, 872-8852.
Hello, this is Donna Sebo, and our telephone lines are now open, 877-876-5227 in the U.S. That's 877-876-5227. Canadians, 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. Also, 530-876-3222. That's 530-876-3222. Quickly, I know we don't have very much time left right now, but I wanted to let you know who is going to be on the air with me for the remainder of this week. We're going to be talking with Stephanie Alexander. The program is going to be all about woman savers. This is so significant, and I'm so delighted that Stephanie is going to be able to be with us. We're going to be talking about some things I think you're going to find very, very interesting. Also, on Thursday, we're going to be talking about the Idiot's Guide to Short Meditation. Well, you didn't think you had to be an idiot to get a guide to find out how to meditate? Believe me, Susan's going to have some fun things to share with us, so we're going to be talking about that. And then, on Friday, we're going to be talking food. How about vegan vittles? Joe Stepaniak is going to be my guest. And we are just going to have a real good time talking about one of our favorite habits and activities, and that is food and eating it. And you can do it, and you can do it well with vegetables. So we're going to be talking about that on Friday. Also, I wanted to remind those of you who are in Northern California that I am going to be appearing in the San Francisco area at the Fort Mason Center at the Wisdom Festival. I will be speaking on Saturday, the 15th of September at 7 o'clock in the evening at that event. And you can go to wisdomfestival.com and get the information from them on their website about the hours, ticket prices, and all of that. We're going to be getting more information to you relative to that, but I want to be sure that you know about my appearance there. Also, I'll be up in Anchorage, Alaska, and Fairbanks, Alaska, during the month of October. And it looks like I've just gotten an invitation to go to New York, so it looks like I will also be going to New York during the month of October. So there's a lot of things going on, and this lady's going to be flying all over the place, but it's doing what I love, and that is being on the air, but also being able to share my knowledge and information with you, my listening audience. Now, before we were able to get with Richard, we were talking for a moment about Elizabeth Anna, and she was having some female problems, and as it turned out, because she had never had very much go wrong with it, she's 42 years of age, she found out that she had a tumor on her cervix. Well, as it turned out, she was told it was cancer. Well, it had spread. By the time she had gotten her pap smear and the testing was done, they found that the tumor was so big, they didn't dare touch it, they didn't dare do anything to it. They thought chemo and radiation was going to be able to shrink it down, it was so large, but Elizabeth Anna just didn't know what to do. So what they did, she and her husband, they decided they'd go for a walk. And she said there were 300 breathtaking acres of flowers. And as upset as she was, she said she felt a real surge of hope when she was looking at all of these gorgeous, gorgeous flowers. And she said to herself, you know, if these flowers can bloom every year, so can I. So she changed her attitude. She had a shift of thinking. She said her diagnosis had come at a perfect time, planting season. Nature had always brought her comfort. Now she needed comfort more than ever. So she said this year she'd grow a lush garden. So she went through the chemo and the radiation. She got busy in her garden, planted all the colors and flowers she loved. And she said every day when she went out in that garden, she felt so peaceful. And she said one day, she decided she was going to do something special for her husband. It was his 50th birthday. Gladiolas were his favorite flowers. She said, I'm going to plant 50 bulbs so they bloom in time for his 50th birthday, and I'm going to be here to see them. Do you know what? On the birthday of her husband, she went in for a checkup that very day. Her tumor had disappeared. She said, I have no cancer even today. So she said, nature calmed my spirit, and I was better able to recover. Nature helped me heal. This is Donna Siebel. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Your mind is power. Your faith is the fertilizer that makes that mind glow and grow. Talk with you tomorrow. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Siebel Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Siebel Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.